I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with Frederick Hudson, who talks to him about his 4-year prison sentence and how he turned that into a venture-funded technology startup. Frederick, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So I came across your story by way of Fast Company, and I was just so taken aback by it, and I thought, this is such a fascinating story. We need to tell this on the show. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, your story, your journey, and how that has led you to what you're up to in the world today?
Yeah, so I was born in Brooklyn, New York, raised down south in Florida, did a small time, about 2 years in the Air Force. And, you know, I've always been interested in business, always been interested in entrepreneurship. Even, you know, in high school, you know, would, you know, do lawn services or car washes and things like that. And even while, you know, when I was 19, started my first business, which was a window tinting shop for vehicles, commercial and residential buildings. Started it with about $500 for my tax return that year and built it up to about 130,000 in sales over the next 6 months. So that was my first time of starting something from, you know, very small, just an idea, finding a good location and going through those motions. And I learned a lot. So for me, I didn't have any formal training in entrepreneurship or business or anything like that. It's just something that I just kind of learned on the fly from, you know, trying and trying stuff and failing and trying again. So that's always been my strength, is that I can see opportunity in everything I look at, but that's also my weakness. And part of that weakness was when I saw people that I grew up with and people that were close to me, struggling in the business that they were in, which was distribution of marijuana. And I saw, you know, hey, you know, I can help you guys make this very efficient. It got so efficient that about 5 years later, when I started that, it got the federal government's attention and I was indicted when I was 23 years old. So that was, you know, a very life-changing event for me, because it took me from, you know, I had never been in trouble before, had no prior criminal record, anything like that. But it just immersed me into the world that I knew nothing about. And, you know, when I started, you know, looking around, I noticed that, you know, this is a huge population of people that no one's paying attention to and most people don't understand. And some of the problems are very simple problems. Of just communication and things like that. And, you know, I knew that there was an opportunity there to make that better. And that's, you know, how Pigeonly started.
You know, I want to go back to the very beginning of this. And I want to ask a little bit about, you know, what your childhood was like, you know, what that whole experience was like growing up that could lead you to making this kind of a decision,
right,
to actually get involved in an opportunity that you knew could possibly get you into trouble.
Yeah, I mean, so growing up, you know, I was always the people, you know, I grew up in a low income neighborhood and, you know, I was a single mother. And we was definitely, when I say we, my siblings and I, we was raised knowing right from wrong. We was raised knowing, you know, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Like there was no question about that. But for me, it was just at the time, the way my brain was processing everything, that the end justified the means. So that's really, you know, the approach that I took, where I wanted to accomplish a goal. When I started first selling drugs, what I was trying to accomplish was, there was a gas station I had my eye on, and, you know, the sales price was, I think it was like $2.2 million, and I had never owned a business before. This is even before I did the tent shop. You know, I was able to get SBA financing lined up. I was able to get the owner to carry back a portion of it. And I was able to get it down to where I only had to come up with $50,000 out of the $2 million. Now, this is over 4 or 5 months, you know, just, you know, hitting my head against the wall and figuring out how business financing worked and loans and all that. And I made a spreadsheet of all the banks that were in the West Coast area, California, Las Vegas, and called each one of them until, you know, I was able to learn. And then every time I got turned down, I would ask the banker, you know, why are you turning me down? And then every time I got every time I was turned down, I learned something new of how to create a better package so that I had a better chance at the next bank. Mm-hmm. So with going through that process, I ended up getting it down to where I only needed $50,000 in cash. And my thinking was, you know, everybody's always going to need gas. I'll be an instant millionaire if I have a gas station. You know, I know a lot better now. But then at 18 years old, mm-hmm. I thought that that would have been a sure way to riches. So When I saw this opportunity, I saw it as a way, it was an easy way and a way that I can make up the difference, make up $50,000 cash doing something else and to be able to go back and get the gas station that I wanted to start, the career and business that I wanted to start. So that's how it started. What happens, though, is that as, you know, you're young and that money comes in so fast and things are moving so fast. And then before you know it, you forget why you even got into it in the first place and you forget why you even started it. And before you know it, you're knee deep into something that you really know you shouldn't be in. But now you've created this lifestyle that you have to support. And so it's just a really vicious cycle of, you know, the further you stay in it, the more your lifestyle changes, and then the more you need to stay in it to support the lifestyle that you just created. So it just continues to go on. And then before you know it, you look up and 5 years has passed and you're still doing the same thing. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of questions come for me from that. You know, to me, this is a story of misguided ambition. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but I think that, you know, we live in a world where everybody is super type A and driven. And I'm really interested in how we look at our ambition and really kind of take a closer look to make sure it's not so misguided, because it seems like, you know, your intentions were good, but you kind of lost your way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, one of the greatest lessons I learned, and one of the things I live by now, is just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. Uh-huh. And that was the one thing. That's the one question that I never asked myself in the past. So if Frederick could do something, Frederick would absolutely do it. And if he saw an opportunity, he would take it. And now, you know, even now, and it's important in business to be disciplined now. And I see that because we're approached with opportunities left and right. Hey, you guys can also do this. You can also do that. But if you want to build a successful business, you really have to stay true to your core. You have to be focused on your core. And just because you can do all these things doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. So back then, had I asked myself that question, yeah, just because I could make quick money distributing marijuana, then it didn't mean that I should have done that. And I should have looked for other ways. Now, from my perspective at the time, being a young African-American male, it was different going through banks and trying to get financing for a business that you don't have any prior history in, or you don't have any experience in. So those things are very difficult. So even though that was the case, you know, for me, it was even more reason, well, I'm going to go do it my way and then come back. So What it's definitely misguided ambition, and for that's the most case of most of the guys that, you know, I spent a lot of time with while I was in prison. Like, these are all, most of the people that are in prison, they're not murderers and killers and people that we're afraid of. They're people that we're mad at, and that's why they're in prison. And they're people that most of what they've done is financially driven. It was a financially driven thing because they took what they saw as the opportunity to create the lifestyle that they felt that they wanted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's a bigger issue when you have, you know, people living in a neighborhood where the only thriving economy is the drug economy, and not small businesses hiring or they may not know that these are doors that I can knock on. Most people don't even know that, hey, I can build my own business. I can do something technology. Nobody around me in my neighborhood did anything in technology. There was no computer developers in my neighborhood. There was nobody in my family or classmates that I could have tapped and said, hey, you know, I'm trying to build this website, let's get together. But that's different had I went to Harvard or had I went to Stanford. So those are part of some of the issues that are broader issues. But nonetheless, you know, you really just have to knock on the door and try anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And that's how we was able to get to where we are now.
So there's two things you said there. You know, you talked about sort of not losing this core of why you're doing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So on that note, I want to ask, sometimes I think that we don't even know what the core is because we've never actually sat down to explore it. It's not something you do in school. It's not something you do in college. It's not even something you do in graduate school. I can tell you through personal experiences, none of those things ever happened to me. I don't ever remember sitting down to say, hey, you know, what is the core? Like, you know, what is it that I believe? What do I value? And I'm really curious, you know, what is the process of self-discovery has it looked like for you? And, you know, if you were to guide somebody on that process now, what would that look like?
That's a great question. So I wouldn't recommend the path that I took, but for me, what it was sitting in a cell for 23 hours a day, right, and being alone with your thoughts and being in a position where you're in an environment where there's no distraction. You're in an environment where you have to be 100% honest with who you are. You have to be 100% honest of what you've done. You have to be 100% honest of what you have accomplished or have not accomplished, mistakes and successes. You have to be honest with all those things. You really have to take a personal assessment of yourself. And it was during that time taking a personal assessment of myself, that's where I started to learn what I was actually good at. So then when I started thinking, okay, well, what am I actually good at? You know, you can say, okay, I'm good at business, but it wasn't that I was good at business. Like, my skill and talent wasn't about business. My skill and talent was troubleshooting. So it didn't matter whether I was troubleshooting a problem with moving drugs from point A to point B. It didn't matter if I was troubleshooting a problem to make it easier for inmates to stay connected, or it didn't matter if I was troubleshooting a problem of, it's 90 degrees in Las Vegas and people are burning their arms because they don't have window tints on their cars. And it was just business was the vehicle in which I can express what my talent was, which was troubleshooting. So what I've learned was that most people, the gifts that they have and the things that is their core is things that they've been doing all your life. So what's your core is something that you've probably been doing since you was a kid or a toddler, that your parents could even tell you, hey, you had a knack for this. You always was this type of thing. I was always that guy. Even when I was a kid, that was always trying to solve a problem, was trying to troubleshoot something. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do for a living now. So you can package this in many different ways. I could have did this in a job. I'd have to do this in my own business. I could have, you know, troubleshoot. I did it for the Air Force. I mean, I was an electrician on the F-16 in the Air Force, and my day every day was fixing the jet when it was broke. So you can do this. You can exercise that same gift. And once you know what that is, and once I identified that, I said, okay, now things are starting to make sense. And I understood why I made the decisions that I made. I understood why I always gravitated towards certain situations. I understood why people always came to me with certain things, and they would come to other people for different things, because I just was good at solving a problem or brainstorming or figuring out a solution to something. That was just what my talent was. Mm-hmm. So once I saw that, I said, okay, well, now I know what my purpose here is on this earth, that I'm here because I have a gift of solving problems. Now I just need to decide what problems do I want to solve. So what better problems to solve than something that I experienced personally, and I knew that I can, you know, make an impact for people that I went through the experience personally. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it started, and I started learning and understanding myself so clearly that, you know, I knew exactly what I was doing, and then I knew I was doing the right thing at the right time with the right people for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, how I discovered what my core was.
How do you get that without spending 23 hours a day?
I think the way to do it it really just starts with self-assessment. I think that a lot of times we look externally for, you know, what our purpose is and what we should do. We look in external sources. And I really think it's you've already been doing it all your life. Like, you've already been that thing. And it's not always this huge grand thing. It doesn't have to be that, you know, I have a gift for playing the piano, or I have a gift for playing a violin. It doesn't have to be that. You can simply have a gift for being a very well strategic planner. And now you can apply that in your own business. You can apply that for an organization that you might work for. You can apply that in family situations. You can apply that in personal relationships. So that might be what it is. And once you understand that, then you look at opportunities for you to be able to apply what your gift is, what your strength is in the world around you. And then that's how you start making an impact. And then you'll discover, it'll find you. Like, the opportunities will come to you. And that's one of the things I've learned, is that once you get in a place where you know what your purpose is and you know what you should do, then opportunities are always there. And really, the difference between people who don't see opportunity and people who do is that the people who do see opportunity are people who are in position to take advantage of it. And a lot of times when I look in the past, the opportunities that when I felt like there was no opportunities, I just was never in a position to take advantage of them. I was never in a position to do anything with them. And that's really where the preparation of, you know, immerse yourself in things that cause you to reflect and think. Immerse yourself in, if you're interested in business, read. I mean, I read Inc. Magazine. I read Wall Street Journal. I read all those publications, even though I didn't know what business I was going to start. I just immersed myself into it. And, you know, over time, it just finds you. I mean, it's really always there. I guess my point is, you don't have to look for it. It's already there.
You know, that's interesting. And I do want to talk about this ability that you seem to have to recognize opportunity. But I want to ask you one other thing. And you know, I thought it was fascinating that you said was that you've had a vehicle to express your talent. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari, here very recently. And he was one of the first people to ever hire Steve Jobs. And he said, you know, there are thousands of Steve Jobs in every organization. But what Steve had really, especially on his return to Apple, was a vehicle to express his talents.
Right.
And that to me is one of those things that seems disconnected from a lot of people's talents. And I'm really interested in how you go about finding the vehicle.
Yeah. I'm a troubleshooter. I'm a problem solver. That's what I am. Okay, cool. Once I knew that, it was now I can choose. There's a million problems in society and the world and around us that you can choose to solve. But for me, it was, what can I make the most impactful, and what can I be so committed to that I'm going to want to stick with this, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether things are going well, whether things are going south, whether I'm happy, whether I'm sad. What is something I can really get 100% behind? And you really just have to be honest with yourself and say, well, am I doing this just for the money? Am I doing this just because I'm doing this for the impact? I'm doing it for a mixture of both. And there's nothing wrong with doing something for the money. It's, you know, it's really just your personal decision. But the problem when you do something just for the money, when the money's not there, you lose that motivation. So that's really the downside of it. So, I mean, the allure or the idea of the money is great to get you going, but it's definitely not going to keep you going. So you really have to be able to find something and be able to choose the vehicle that you know that you're going to be passionate about. And that's why entrepreneurs are so passionate about what they're working on. It's like their baby, it's like their child. And once you apply, you know, your core to something that you know you can be passionate about, whether it's good or bad, whether it's going well or going south, then, you know, that's really when you shine. And that's really when people will recognize your gifts and talents, because you're really going to thrive in that thing.
I love that. So let me ask you this. One of the things that, you know, we've talked about throughout this is that you have this ability to recognize opportunity. And I've asked a few people this question. Do you think that the ability to recognize opportunity is something that is just inherent into who you are as a person? Or do you think that's something that we can cultivate and develop?
Definitely. 100% cultivate. 100%. So, yeah, I mean, I talk to my friends and my peers about this a lot. And I don't think I'm special in the event where I see the glasses half full. I don't think that's nothing unique. I think I trained myself to look for the opportunity in everything I look at. And it's really, I do that just because if I don't, I'll be fucking depressed all day. I mean, so it's like you have to train yourself to, regardless of what's happening, even every day in business, like, you know, it's a constant of ebbs and flows. It's constant valley, mountain, valley, mountain, valley, mountain. So if you don't train yourself to be able to see the bright side or the silver lining in just about everything that's happening, then you won't be the kind of person anybody else wants to be around, and you won't be the kind of person that your organizations want to follow as the leader. Because if you can't believe it, and even if you don't believe it, act like you believe it, then nobody else can either. So it's really training yourself to really, and what I find is that I don't see situations as good or bad at this point. So I've gotten to the point where they're just kind of static, and I can look at something and there's bad sides to it, but there's also good sides. There's things that I can control, there's things that I can't control. And really what I focus on is, what do I have control over in the situation? And everything I don't have control over, I completely ignore, because I don't put any energy into things that I can't control. So, and what I've noticed is, what that appears to on the outside, people just think I'm very lucky. Mm-hmm. But it's not that I'm lucky, it's just that I really put all my energy into things that I have control over, as opposed to stressing or worrying about things that are completely out of my control. So I recognize, to sum it up, I recognize what I do have control over and focus my energy on that. And that's usually is the good part of whatever situation I'm in.
So let me ask you this. How do you train that? How do you train that as an individual? And how can we do that in small doses on a day-to-day basis in our lives?
I think as situations happen, I really believe that the way the... For me, there's always that tape that's going on in my head. And, you know, sometimes that voice, and this voice is usually always negative. Like, this is not going to work. I'm worried about this. I'm worried about that. And this tape just goes on and on and on and on. And I consciously try to turn that tape off. I constantly try to control my thoughts, and I constantly try to correct myself when negative thoughts about a situation start surfacing, as they will, which is natural for that to happen. I've noticed that when I dwell on those things actually come into fruition. So I don't want to get too far. People start thinking, okay, well, this might be too hard to grasp, but I've actually noticed that the way my thoughts and my mind produces actual how things happen around me. And I don't know if that's maybe the way I react to situations starts from the way I thought. I mean, I can't tell you why this is, but I do notice that, you know, the more positive I am, the more positive circumstances are around me. And the more negative I am, the more negative things circumstances are around me. So for me, I just try to consciously, it's just a conscious effort to be positive. It's a conscious effort, even when I'm having conversations, to have positive conversations. It's a conscious effort to avoid negative people. It's a conscious effort to put people around me that are also positive. So all those things are conscious efforts that I do that actually create this environment where you can be creative and collaborative and positive. And then from the outside looking in, it's just like, wow, those guys are just, you know, think good things just happen to them, when it's not really that. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're actually putting conscious effort in building a surrounding where we can be focused and we can execute and we can do things, because we're trying to remove as much negativity out of a situation as possible.
You know, it's interesting. As I listen to you say that, I can't help but think back to a conversation I had with a guy named Dave Logan, who wrote a book called The Three Laws of Performance, one of our former guests here on the show. And for those of you guys who are listening, definitely worth checking out if you haven't heard it. But, you know, in The Three Laws of Performance, they talk about how language is inseparable from reality, and that voice in our head actually creates a picture.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as you said, you know, you can kind of take the same situation. You can tell two facts about it, both equally true, and one will produce a very different experience for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's so true. I mean, I see it every day. And for us, it's, I mean, I just really, and it, actually, I learned this while I was in prison. So in prison, you're in a very small, you're in this closed community with, you know, you might be, you know, let's say 3,000 people. And these 3,000 people, you live, eat, sleep, everything with these 3,000 folks. Like, you're doing everything with them all the time. And what happens is you have no choice on who you're around. I don't have the choice if I'm around somebody who's negative. I don't have a choice if I'm around somebody who's positive. So what you learn, what I learned was how important it was to protect my environment. When I say my environment, it was just my circle. Mm-hmm. And whether that just be me by myself or other people around me, I always had to try to always maintain a positive outlook on what I was doing, where I was going, and removing any type of person that could have been negative. And what I've noticed is that it takes energy. When you have a negative person around you, you feel drained, you feel tired, and it really takes conscious effort to remove that and to kind of get back to your normal self. And so that's how I started learning how powerful it was to really control your environment when you want to accomplish something, when you're trying to build something, mm-hmm. and to have the people around you that can support that.
Well, you know, I love that you brought up environment, because that really was going to be my next question. And there's some interesting things about environment that I'd really like to spend some time talking with you about as well. But, you know, you mentioned growing up, you know, basically in a low income family. I mean, you came from, you know, a background that, you know, for most people would say is an environment that generally wouldn't lead to a positive outcome. Right. One of the things that has always interested me about environments is how do we not become a byproduct of our environment? Because I see that happen to so many people. And then I see other people who, in spite of their environment, end up on a very different track.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the people that I know that that despite their environment ended up on a different track are the people who were conscious. You know, they became conscious. And most people, you know, for example, in neighborhoods that I come from, they're just asleep. They're alive and they're awake, but they're asleep at the same time. So it's just going through the motions. And most of that comes from where I don't even realize that I have these options. So in my mind is very closed off, and I don't even know that this is an option. I don't even know that I can build a company that does this. I don't even know that, for me, all I know is that I have to get a job or you know, sell drugs, or these are my options. And I think that really just comes from people not realizing or not opening mind, or just being what I call sleep. Mm-hmm. and not seeing that, okay, these are things that you can do. And I think part of it is because I don't see other people that look like me that are doing these things, so I assume that's not for me. And so the more people that awake and see and start doing things, and the more people that say, okay, well, I see you guys. So it's no coincidence that, you know, the average young African-American male in a low income neighborhood, you know, his opportunities, he's going to see it as either sports or the music industry. It's no coincidence, because the people that he sees as successful that look like him, that's where they are. They're not doctors. They're not lawyers. They're not astronauts. They're not the CEOs of technology companies. That's not who he sees. So the people he sees, they look completely different than him. And that's true for other demographics. That's true for other people and other races. When you, if you don't see yourself in those areas, it's really hard to know that this is something that's for you. So I think that the more of us that, you know, start knocking on doors that traditionally we may not be in, then it, all it does is now wakes other people up and say, okay, that's something I can knock on too. Or this idea that's been rolling in my head that, you know, I didn't think that I can do. Now I see that, you know, he did it, so I can too. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to start changing, you know, communities and for communities to see other people in other lights of doing other things.
You know, it's interesting because as you're saying that, I think about, you know, the community I grew up in and seeing doctors really being Indian as sort of that's right. The example of success.
Right, exactly.
You know, doctors
exactly.
And engineers. It's like, these right. This is what's possible. These are the people that are successful.
Right, exactly. The same principle. Same principle.
Exactly. You know what? I want to spend some time, actually spend the rest of our time talking about your time in prison, but I have one other question before mm-hmm. this period, you know, about the Air Force and mm-hmm. how your time in the Air Force really has sort of influenced and shaped your life, your worldview, and what that's brought into you as a person.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the military was great for me. So the person that planted the seed in my mind for the military was my uncle. And at the time, the uncle was probably the most successful person in the family. And, you know, because he was the one that he went to school. He went to the military, then when he went to the military, you know, he went all the way up in the ranks and, you know, he was the guy that was successful. He was the guy in the family when somebody needed something, that's who they went to. So for me growing up and seeing that, it's like, okay, yeah, that's, if I want to be successful, military is a great, that's a great thing for me to do because my uncle did it, I can do it too. So that's how it started. So, you know, I went to the Air Force and, you know, I did well. One of the things that I learned in the Air Force was how to work with all different types of people. So the Air Force and prison are very similar, where you're around people, all different types of people from different backgrounds, different races, different everything, and different cultures. And you learn to work with these folks. You learn to get along with these folks, and you build. You start learning how to lead. And that's one of the things that I learned in Air Force is how to lead. I learned also. Their military is insanely efficient. They're insanely efficient in everything that they do. And that's kind of where I picked up, you know, stuff that we, you know, do in our company now is how to be efficient, how to create processes and systems so that regardless whether it's me doing it or a customer service rep that's doing it, the outcome is exactly the same. McDonald's is a good example of that. No matter what McDonald's you go through, you're going to have the same amount of fries in your container. You're going to have your Big Mac's going to taste exactly the same. So those are the type of processes that I started seeing in the military where, you know, they have these folks and everyone had a very specific task and a role, but it was always efficient. The outcome was always the same regardless whether I did this task or whether somebody else did this task. And so those are some of the things I learned. And then on top of that, it was discipline. You know, it was one of the things where regardless of, you know, the difference between living how you feel and living by what you know. And that's something that the military really drills in is that it doesn't matter how you feel about the situation. You have to live by, you know. So you may not feel like getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and going for a run, but you know you need to. So you're going to do it anyway, regardless of how you feel. So, you know, it was probably those three things that stood out to me, you know, working with people from all different backgrounds, learning how to be efficient and do things and always having a sense of urgency in what you're doing and then not living based on how you feel, living by what you know. And, you know, that's really stuck with me and helped me, you know, to work on the stuff and build the stuff that we're building on.
I want to take a quick break to share an exciting announcement with you. As you know, we've made lots of changes over the past year, and now we're making the next addition to our team. Today, I'm thrilled to announce our Community Instigator program. We're looking for 5 people to join our team as evangelists for the podcast, the community, and our message. Here's what that involves. You'll be helping us to widely promote and share the podcast, drive new listeners to the show, bring new ideas to increase the size of the community and our reach, provide feedback on various new projects and products, and lead our Facebook community. It's a volunteer role, but as an evangelist, here's what's in it for you. You'll have an invitation to be part of next year's Instigator experience. You'll get an opportunity to work with us in shaping the show. You'll get input into guest selection and special projects and insight into what's next before anyone else knows. If it sounds exciting, we want to hear from you. Make sure you fill out an application by this Sunday at midnight. Go to unmistakablecreative.com/community to learn more. Now let's get back to the show. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit, and let's start talking about your time in prison. I mean, you get to that moment of being indicted. What goes through your head in a moment like that? I mean, it must really shake you to the core, I would think.
Yes, absolutely. It's crazy. It's one of those things where you have no way to understand or be prepared until you're in the middle of it. And at that point, it's too late. So it's like that. So, like, I had no clue how the prison system worked. I had no clue what conspiracy even meant. So I'm naive. I'm thinking that, okay, you have to, in order to go to jail for something or to get arrested for something, you have to get caught with drugs in your hand. You have to get caught with doing something illegal. I had no concept of, you don't have to get caught doing anything. All we need is somebody else to say that you was involved, and that's enough. So it was a very awakening experience of how the criminal justice system works. And it's one of those things where on a federal level, there's no expensive lawyer that's going to get you out of it. It's kind of like a cookie cutter type system where this is what the charge is. You know, we have a 98% conviction rate. You can take it to trial if you want to, but the chances of you winning is 2%, or you can take this plea bargain. So it's really like a factory. It's very, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a game that you can play and win, I guess is what I'm saying. So not knowing, but you don't know that when you're in the streets and, you know, you're doing reckless things. You're not thinking that. You're thinking that, you know, oh yeah, you know, this is the game. This would be a slap on the wrist. It's not a big deal. But it's very different. So it's traumatizing on you. It's traumatizing on your family. And, you know, when they're reading off that indictment, they're talking about you. You're listening to the charges they're reading off. You're like, who are they talking about? Like, is that me that they're talking about? Like, I'm not. Like, you start believing the stuff they're saying. You think that you're a monster. So it's a very interesting thing to go through. And it's a very awakening. It's a very awakening event. I mean, going in prison, it's the one environment on this earth where you have absolutely no control. You have no control over anything, no control over whether you eat, no control of when you sleep, no control of who you sleep next to, when you take a shower. You have no control of anything. And when you take someone who might be entrepreneurial, you take someone who is used to, who wants to build something and create their own destiny, it's a huge culture shock for you know, that type of personality.
Mm-hmm. So what is the process of integrating into something like that, to go from the environment that you were in to the environment mm-hmm. prison? I mean, what does that look like psychologically? I mean, and what misconceptions do we as people on the outside have about life on the inside?
Yeah, one is that you see on prison, like, you don't walk in prison and go pick a fight with the biggest guy that you see there. that's one. That's one easy one. And so, I mean, the institutions, prison environment is very interesting. So one of the things that I noticed is that it's its own society. It's its own society with its own set of rules and its own set of consequences and its own everything. So basically, inmates themselves run institutions. The staff that's there is really, their job is to make sure you don't leave and make sure you don't kill each other. But the inmates run the institution. So what's happening is that it's a place where what you say and your word, that's it. So if you say that I'm going to do this, or I'm going to give you $2 for this, then you better have $2. If the consequences isn't going to be a negative credit score rating, the consequences will be much more severe. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you people learn to live by their word. People learn that respect is the number one most important thing there. And what happens when you have an environment like that, these people naturally start respecting each other, and these people naturally start, you know, somebody bumps you, oh, excuse me, that's what happens. Because if I don't say excuse me, if I end up to bump into a white guy, now I have to deal with 800 white guys that are pissed off because I disrespected one white guy. And if the white guy bumped into a black guy, now he has to deal with 800 black guys that are pissed off that he bumped into that one black guy. So what happens is the white guy and the black guy, we respect each other. And at the same time, It's very segregated. It's a very segregated, or for lack of a better term, racist environment. So the Spanish community don't mix with the white community. The white community don't mix with the black community or the Spanish community. And everyone sits on separate tables. And that's how it is. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is driven from you know, their strength in numbers. And a lot of that is driven from different cultures just stick together, just for the sake of and protection of that whole group. Mm-hmm. So I mean, what you end up seeing is what's end up happening is that you just really, you know, especially when the higher levels, as you get down to the lower levels, like the camps, it's very different. It's more of a college campus that you just don't leave, like a dormitory type setup. But, you know, in the higher institutions where I started, you know, it's a very, especially on the West Coast, it's a very, very emotionally charged environment where you're always on your P's and Q's, but your people are always respectful. People are always sticking by their word, because at the end of the day, you're in an environment where your word is all you have. So if you say you're gonna do something, you better do it. And that's really how it operates. That's the kind of ecosystem that it is.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about this. I mean, far too often I hear stories of the fact that this system doesn't actually rehabilitate anybody. In fact, most people who go there the first time end up coming back.
Right.
We had another guy here named Andy Dixon who talked about serving 27 years. And he said, you know, what's really disturbing is that people who are planning at the state level actually plan the number of prison beds that we have based on the kids of the people that are currently in prison. So effectively, right, they're planning for the worst.
Right.
And yet, you built a business from behind bars, and you've come out as a startup CEO. So I really want to talk about that process and you know, your mindset during all of this that enabled all of that, and of course, you know, what you saw as the reason for doing this.
Yeah. So I mean, I agree. Institutions right now, the model is more of a warehousing model as opposed to a rehabilitation model. And mainly that's because of the length of sentences that you get for crime. So I think the biggest and the easiest way I can say this is that we're putting people in jail that we're mad at instead of just putting people in jail that we're afraid of. So there's a difference. So I came across people that should be in jail that I would not want walking on the street with my sister or mother or anybody else. Mm-hmm. But then I saw also hundreds and thousands of people that in jail that were just mad at, that just did something stupid. And if you take someone who just did something stupid and you put them in prison for 10 years, it is very hard. It is very hard for that person to come out and rebuild a successful life after that. It is very difficult. So even small things like from renting, you know, even with us being a venture backed company, I still had to jump through hoops to even rent an apartment, even though I can pay my rent for 2-3 years up front at one payment. It's still, you have to check the box that you're a felon. Regardless of what my family is, I have a drug case. We can't rent to you. Even having a simple thing as a bank account. So you can't open a bank account. Now, I understand if it's a financial crime. I understand if it's bank fraud or wire fraud or things like that. I can understand that not wanting to readily give that person a bank account again. I can understand that having an extra process in place for that. But if you take a guy that came from a life of streets and now he comes out and he tries to rebuild his life, and you don't want to give him a bank account. You don't want him to rent an apartment. You don't want him to do the things that normal producing members of society do. It's very, very easy to go back to the life that he once lived, where those things are not necessary. Mm-hmm. So and so that's part of the issue. So that's a broader problem. But for me personally, how I focused my time and how I spent my time is I knew that I could not rely on someone to give me a job or someone to give me an opportunity once I was released. I knew that I would be competing against people who also need a job but don't have to check the box that they're a felon. So I knew that, you know, I had to create something for myself and I had to find a problem. But once again, I knew that my strength was solving a problem. So I knew I had to solve a problem that not only that I felt I can actually make an impact, but I actually felt that I can do and do better than anybody else. So it wasn't just trying to find something that I can do. Like I could do anything. I can sell popsicles. I live in Las Vegas, so I can set up a stand on Fremont Street and I can sell popsicles. It's hot. People will buy them. I'll make money. I probably can make a good living. But I want to do something that I can do better than anybody else. And I felt that from my own personal experience going through it and understanding this culture, understanding not only the inmates, what the inmates go through, but also the family members and all the people, my family that went through this same process with me, what they go through. And I felt that we can build a solution, not that didn't exist, not that we invented something brand new, but we could be the tall man in a room for the midgets. And that was my goal, to be the tall man in a room for the midgets, build something that we could own and be better than anybody else that's doing it. And that's how we ended up to where we're at. Hmm.
So talk to us about what Pigeonly does exactly, because I got to read about it, but I'd love for our listeners to hear.
Sure. So Basically, Pigeonly, we're a data platform and we aggregate and collect information on the nation's incarcerated. So the first problem that we solve is that all incarcerated information, any prison and or inmate information is all public record. But like most public records, state records don't talk to each other. So, for example, Florida doesn't talk to Texas. Texas doesn't talk to Michigan. Michigan doesn't talk to California. So if someone's looking for someone that might be in prison, they have to know what institution or what state to go searching to find that person, and then they have to try to identify what's their address and to be able to interact with them to send them a letter or send them photos and any of that thing. So that's the first part. That's really the core of our company. So really the core of our business is a database that we built that allows us to not only target and reach this demographic, because traditionally it's been unreachable, but also allows us to identify and know where people are in real time. So to give you an idea of a use case, so for example, if we wanted to target everyone who's currently in prison that's going to have a birthday this month, we can do that query in our database and we'll get a list of matches and we'll know, okay, we have 100,000 people that's currently in prison that's going to have a birthday in the month of September. So that's kind of a quick use case. So fast, let me back up. So that's what we built last, interestingly enough. What we built first, all I was trying to do when I was released was my biggest pain point, my biggest gripe with my family, who I knew loved me and cared about me, was you guys never sent me photos. Why was it so hard for me to get you to send me photos? And like, once again, it wasn't that they didn't care about me. It wasn't that they didn't love me. It was just that it was very time consuming and difficult. So the process then was you have to go to get the media off your phone at either Walgreens or CVS and get it printed, then go to a post office and then mail it. And then you have to figure out what my mailing address is. And most people in prison, they're from low income families, which means the people on the outside are usually, their family members are also low income. And the same time that they're at work is the same time the post office is open. So all this to go buy a stamp and mail a package off, and it's just not going to happen, because it's just we're at this point, we're just really trying to maintain this household, because usually the breadwinner is the one that's not in that household anymore. Mm-hmm. So when I came home, that's what I wanted to do. So I said, you have smartphones, you have companies like Shutterfly, you have companies like Snapfish. They've been doing this for years. They've been uploading photos and printing them and mailing it for years. Why hasn't anybody built a solution that'll work in an institutional environment? And that's what I set out to do. So while I was in a halfway house, I got with my co-founder, Alfonso, and we built the first prototype, what's now known as Photo Pigeon. And the concept is very simple. You can go to the website, you upload the photos that you want. We have a fulfillment company that prints and mails the photos, and the inmate will get the actual 4x6 in the mail 3 to 5 days later. Very, very easy. Very, very simple. And when we got ready to market the product, I knew that the best way to identify who's currently in prison, because that's who the best way to identify the families was to start by targeting people who's in prison, because doing Google AdWords or Facebook ads and things like that, doing traditional marketing, is very hard to identify out of this room full of people who actually has a loved one that's currently in prison that they want to talk to. So we decided to go the opposite. We decided to start with the inmate and work our way backwards. So I assumed that because criminal records are public information, a public record, I assumed that they were easily accessible, and I learned that I could not do a Google search and find out who was in prison in California. It just didn't exist. So that's how we built the first part of what I just told you, was a database to know exactly where prisons were. So basically what we have is algorithms that index public records 24 hours a day. And once it identifies someone that has a criminal case, it'll then check all the databases to see which prison facility this inmate might be. And then once we identify that, we store it, and then we continue to refresh it every day so we always know where he is. And that's essentially what it does. So how that works for Photo Pigeon is, what mom has to do now, she just has to put Frederick Hudson when she creates her account and hit search, and then all the Frederick Hudsons pop up. And she's, okay, my Frederick is this guy, and she selects my name. At this point, whenever she sends photos, it automatically goes to the right address, even when I move. So another problem, even with attorneys, have this issue, is that inmates move from place to place a lot. I was in 8 different institutions throughout the short 51 months that I was there. And I say short because relatively for prison sentence, that's a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. So, it would have been almost impossible. Even my co-founder, who knows my first and last name, he knows my date of birth, he knows my social, he knows everything about me. He couldn't even find me to be able to send me a letter. I would get letters. All the letters he would send me would go back to him, because they was always going to the wrong spot, or I would have moved by the time he identified the right address. So we take all the work out of that, where we maintain the addresses on our end. So all the family member or the user has to do is select the photos they want to send from their Facebook or their Instagram or their device and just hit the send button, and that's it. So it's very seamless. It's essentially as easy as sending a text message. We even added the capability so that you can just send text a photo to a number that's associated with your inmate and it's automatically processed. You don't even have to go to the website at all. So we just made that process very easy and it paid off. Once again, we didn't invent anything. We didn't do anything that was groundbreaking. We just became the tall man in a room full of midgets. And now we have, you know, we're shipping, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 photos a day now on Photo Pigeon. Where we started, you know, we was doing, you know, maybe 5 or 10. But so that's kind of,
let me ask you this. Talk to me about the process of reintegration after coming out. Because, you know, we had a friend here who also served time, and she said that coming out of prison is almost harder than going in.
It is.
And I'd love to hear your take on that whole experience, especially given that, you know, you started this while you were in there and then you came out and you're, you know, a venture-backed CEO with it. I'm very curious about your entire reintegration experience.
Yeah, it was, it's tough. I mean, it's doable. And the way I look at it is if you make it through your sentence, you know, what guys have to see is they have to know that if I made it through whatever my sentence is, then I'm strong enough to make it through this last phase, which is the reintegration. So it is tough. I mean, it's hard because you're out of touch. So I was gone for almost 5 years and the world changed so much. I mean, I didn't know how to use a smartphone. I didn't know, you know, a lot of things I didn't know how to use. I didn't even know how to use Facebook, you know, when I was released. So there was things that were new to me that I had to learn. You know, I didn't know how do I, you know, go about getting a car loan or a place to live and all those things. And then I learned that, okay, well, I knew that I couldn't vote because I have a felony background. I didn't know I couldn't rent an apartment if I have a job. I didn't know that. So now how do I deal with that? I didn't know I can't open a bank account. Like, so that's probably what makes it difficult. And if you don't have a strong support network, if you don't have a family members and friends, or if you wasn't able to maintain those connections, it's almost impossible to have successful reintegration. And that's the problem with the current setup of institutions is that they make it creates isolation. And isolation is the worst thing that can happen to an inmate. And what happens is that majority of guys that are in prison don't have life sentences, which means the majority of guys that are in prison are going to be released at some point in time in the future. What happens when you isolate them and they lose touch with every positive on every connection that they may have, whether it be their mother, whether it be their wife, whether it be a coworker, whether it be a college buddy, whoever it may be. If you lose touch with all those people when you're released, you're just thrown out and you don't even have a clue where to start. So that's why the recidivism rate is what it is. It's because people go back to what they know at that point. All I do know is this, and I'm going to go back to that. Not that it's right, but that's just the reality of what it is. Uh-huh. So when you have that support network, when you release and you have that family member, you have those people that can support you like I had, then, you know, you have that cushion so that you can find a job. Like, for example, right now we have interns. We have interns that people are currently released and people that we hire that are currently released. And, you know, it's difficult for them to go and look. I mean, I hear the stories, you know, they're happy when they come across us because we're happy to hire people that's been in that situation. And, you know, when they've been looking for a place to work that, you know, they get turned down because they have to check that box, regardless of what they actually did. So, it is difficult. I mean, I have guys on my email that I talk to, that I mentor, you know, I'm looking for employment, you know, any advice, you know, I've been out for 6 months, can't find a job, been out for 6 months, you know, my people are getting tired of me at this point, you know, cause I'm not contributing. Most of these people, they want to contribute. They want to be productive members. They want to support their family. They want to make the people that care about them proud again. And it's just very difficult. When you have this discrimination that happens when you have been incarcerated.
You know, it's really interesting because, you know, the reason I ask this question is when you talk about isolation, I think about that in terms of any traumatic experience and how recovering from any sort of trauma requires a support system, that being right. One of the most integral parts, regardless of whatever it is.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's very true. And that's kind of how the company, that's really the problem that I sought to solve. So what I noticed was that the way the institution environment is set up, where you have a vendor that wins a contract, and this vendor that wins a contract promises the institution X number of dollars for a kickback. And now this one vendor controls all the prices for X product. Let's use the phones, for example. So now if the vendor decides that they want to charge, and I have paid $15 for a 15-minute phone call, if he decides he wants to pay that much, I have no choice but to pay that. But I'm not the one that's carrying that burden. My family is. So as they're paying that burden for them, they're paying that cost so that I can keep in touch with them, call them once a week or every 2 weeks or once a month. you know, eventually, you know, we can't talk as much. We just can't. And there's no reason for phone calls in this day and age to be $15 a minute. It just doesn't make sense. I can call Tokyo for less, or I can call India for less. So it's just one of those things where you're taking someone who's already in a bad situation, you're making a situation that much more worse. And now you create an environment where he's isolated from everything that's positive in his life. The people, regardless of what someone did, your mom always is going to love you. So if you isolate that person from the one person that loves him and wants to support them, it's going to be a really hard time for him to be released and rebuild his life when he gets out. And that's really what we work to solve. So what we do is that we don't deal with institutions directly at all. We build all of our products to deal directly with decision makers. So, for example, we give each inmate up to 5 free photos a week, where anyone can send him 5 free photos, whether he can pay us now or he can never pay us at all. He can get up to 5 free photos a week. And then anything past those 5 free photos, the family member, whoever sent him photos, will pay 50 cents a print. And the shipping is free. On our phone product, we do the same thing. So we was the first company to give out free minutes. I mean, we've given out over 4 million free minutes, saving families over $700,000 in phone time that we've given out for free. And as part of our mission of, regardless whether you could afford to pay us or not, you should at least be able to talk 20 minutes a month. That's at least one phone call that you can make home, and you don't have to pay for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the technology and the cost of things going down, you know, nobody's never really taken an approach to offer this demographic the same things that we're used to. We don't pay for email. We would balk at the idea of paying for email. Inmates pay 5 cents a minute to send an email. So it's things like that that, you know, I'm not saying that it has to be free, but it doesn't have to cost what they're charging, I guess is my point. So, for example, even with our phone product that we launched, we have the free plan where it's a forever free plan, so they can use it forever for a max of 20 minutes a month. And we reset the minutes every month for 20 minutes free. And then if they want to pay, the highest plan that they can choose, there's only 2 plans. One's $5 a month, one's $10 a month. The highest they can ever pay is $10. So we build things to be part of the solution and to disrupt the current business model of really, you know, for lack of a better term, just extorting people that don't have an option. So if you're the only company and I don't have the option to go to a cheaper provider, then, and you can charge me $1 a minute, you know, what can I do?
Mm-hmm. You know, I really love that there's so much of a sense of mission and purpose behind everything you do. That to me really resonates on so many levels. And I knew, you know, when I read about your story, that's why I wanted to have you on the show. So I want to close with one final question, and this is how we end all our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
That's a great question. I think for me, you know, I think I get asked that question different ways often. And it's kind of like I have such a peace that I know that I'm doing the right thing at the right time with the right people for the right reasons, that regardless of what happens tomorrow in my business, regardless whether things go south, whether things go good or bad, I know I'm doing the right thing. So I'm going to keep going forward. You know, I was just talking to one of our investors the other night, and we was talking about the same subject is, you know, it really always comes up, especially when you start raising capital and you start getting outsiders to invest in your dream or your vision, is how do I know you're not going to quit? How do I know that you're really going to see this through? And when you have the confidence that you know that you're doing the right thing at the right time, and you're addressing the right problem, you're solving the right thing at the right time, you're doing it for the right reasons, then it's very hard to get swayed. It's very difficult to throw in the towel at that point. And that's where that passion, you know, burns very hot, and it'll drive you, you know, when, you know, other people might throw in the towel.
I love it. Well, Frederick, this has been just absolutely fascinating, as I kind of knew it would be. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share some of your insights with our listeners here at Unmistakable Creative.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Had a great time.
Yeah, and I hope you guys have enjoyed the episode, and we'll wrap with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.